Flying High on Locked On Eagles, your daily source for the best Philadelphia Eagles news and analysis, brought to you by LockedOnEagles.com. I am your host, Michael Kist. You can follow my work at Inside the Pylon, Breaking Football, Grandstand Sports Network. Follow me on Twitter at Michael J. Kist. That is K-I-S-T. As always, I am joined by the best co-host in the game, Mr. 7-Year Streak Without a Bad Day, DJ Frog with Pockets. He is Benjamin Solak of Bleeding Green Nation and NDT Scouting. You can follow him on Twitter at Benjamin Solak. That's S-O-L-A-K. Ben, how you doing, brother? It's been a while.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm doing quite well. I hope that you enjoyed your day off while I held down the fort. Steadfast, good soldier, the watcher on the wall. My watch has now ended after one day, but I held it down, so I hope I did you proud.
Yeah, yesterday was the Locked On Rams crossover, so they did a lot of previewing, a lot of good info in that show. Go check that show out if you haven't yet. I had the day off, like Ben said, but what I do want to talk about a couple different aspects about this game coming up before we hit our full-on preview with just me and Ben on Friday for the Friday show. First, go to LockedOnEagles.com. I just dropped a enemy evaluation about Todd Gurley, the running back for the Rams, who everyone decided was a bust after season two, despite the Rams having no offensive identity or offensive line to speak of, and a struggling rookie quarterback. But it's whatever. It's whatever. You know, I'm going to sip some tea on that one. Yeah, so I'm going to also have a enemy evaluation of Cooper Kupp dropping, which is a special one because that's from his college scouting report. And I was a Cooper Kupp fan. What about you, Ben?
Yeah, how high were you on Cooper Kupp? I received some solid flack for how high I was on Kupp, and I'm feeling pretty good about that eval. Where do you remember where you had him? I'm looking mine up right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, on my report, I had him as an early fourth rounder, if I'm not mistaken. And I think I was... I was still... But, you know, I had him as a wide receiver four that could also be a decent slot that would contribute immediately. You know what I mean? Not a game breaker, but a solid piece that you could work with from day one because of the nuance in his route running and things of that nature. So how high did you have him?
11, 12. Yeah, I had him wide receiver 13, mid-third round grade, top 100 prospect. Yeah. He was above Taywan Taylor. He was above Chad Hansen. He was above your boy, KD Cannon. He was above D.D. Westbrook, Ryan Switzer, all of these players. Again, and talking with the Rams guys, you heard them talk about this. He wasn't the best athlete, and we knew this. We knew he wasn't the greatest athlete. Wide receivers as smart as Cooper Kupp, who are as good at creating throwing windows, are incredibly valuable, especially in an offense like Sean McVay's, where he just executes good routes against coverages, create space, and then he struggled a little bit with drops early, but he's very sure-handed overall, right? And so he fell into a great system. So, you know, I'm not going to take all the credit there, but Cooper Kupp definitely was poo-pooed a little bit in the process for not being a great athlete. He's an older dude and whatever. He's like the oldest receiver they have now, the Rams, because they've got Watkins and Reynolds and Tavon Austin, like all these young guys. Anyway, Cooper Kupp, good football player.
Yeah, he turned 24 in June, and people were like, he doesn't have any room to grow or anything. I'm like, he's a ready product. He's not the most dynamic one, but some people were saying he's like not even day three. Like, it was a little bit over the top. Anyway, we have been proven right on that so far. You're a little bit higher on him. That's probably where I was with him initially, and then I kind of rolled back a little bit, which is probably a mistake, but we'll see over time. The jury is still out on these rookies. One thing I wanted to talk about this game coming up, the Rams are going to run stunts with Robert Quinn and Aaron Donald and the like. And when I watched the All-22 for the Eagles-Seahawks game, and then I went back and watched some more All-22 from the Eagles-49ers game.
That's the one.
Both games, the Eagles struggled really hard with stunts, and especially against the Seahawks on the left-hand side, where Wisniewski and Halepulivahtivaihtai gave up a combined 19 pressures on 50 dropbacks.
That's suboptimal.
Yeah, suboptimal is the correct word for that. So what did you see from our line against stunts? Do you think this is something that we can get fixed, not only just in time for this game coming up, but for the playoffs as well? Because it looks like the book is out on how to get pressure on us.
Absolutely. So this is a great conversation. This is a good, I think, O-line dedicated episode, at least for the majority of it, because we got to talk about the conception of Halepulivahtivaihtai and whether or not he's the future in Philadelphia moving forward. We've got to talk a little bit about Isaac Seumalo as a guard and a center, right? Because you hear people talk all the time, draft a quarterback every year, right? You know, Ron Wolf, big proponent of this strategy, you know, that kind of entire tree of GMs, that family. And I'm not saying that that's incorrect, but one of the extensions of that is you should be drafting in the trenches almost every single draft. You really should be, you know, that's you're going to draft a quarterback every draft, but you should draft dudes who protect the quarterback every single draft as well. Because as we saw, you know, when you don't have those players, quarterback can be very effective. You alluded to it with Goff. We saw it with Wentz in his rookie season when he lost Lane Johnson. And that brings us to this discussion. You know, one of those stats that was thrown around with Lane Johnson being injured in 2016 was, oh, Carson has played with X amount of line combinations, right? And you remember, you know, there was Alan Barber injuries, right? Jason Peters was out for, I believe, a little bit of time. You know, you had, you know, Isaac Seumalo playing tackle at one point. He's like the fourth string guy, right? This is not good situations. When you play with all these different variations of offensive lines, what you lose is communication. And communication is the key along the offensive line. If you remember, a few weeks ago, we were on a pod speaking, and I said that the reason the Eagles' offensive line is playing so well, and the reason this running game is so dangerous, is because they have the athleticism and the continuity, you know, that right side of the line I was focusing on, Kelce, Brooks, and Johnson, where I said all three should be Pro Bowlers.
Yep.
Because they have such great continuity, such great communication, they can do different things. No matter how you deploy your defensive front, they have an answer. You're playing head up on Kelce, all right, well, then he's going to be able to reach you. You're playing shaded, well, they're just going to pin and fold underneath you, right? Mm-hmm. You've got a gap here, they're going to take advantage of it. You know, if you slant, if you deploy, if you do this, they'll be able to handle that and they can run it against you. Now, in the passing game, that becomes a lot less of the offensive line dictating and a lot more of reacting, which communication becomes even more important. Now we set up, the blitz is coming at us, the rushers are coming at us a certain way. How do we pass them off? Who gets who gets what? If you watch, you know, offensive line play, you'll very often see when the center snaps the football, he doesn't drop straight back unless somebody's directly on top of him, right? He'll move either to his left or to his right. These are slide protections, right? That's a very basic example. You can see that on every single Sunday of how offensive lines have communicated via what they've seen pre-snap, how they're going to deploy their protection. The center does that and the quarterback does that as well. When you have a second-year player like Big V on the left-hand side and you have a not originally starting left guard and Steven Wisniewski on the left side, you're in a situation where these guys have not seen significant amount of practice reps next to each other. They didn't spend the offseason learning all of the protection schemes and all the calls next to each other. They were next to different people. They were on different depth charts. They were in different places. And now, you know, the more and more game experience you get, the better and better that becomes, certainly. But we saw a Seahawks team with really great timing, a well-coached defensive line, a well-coached defense with talent in general, but with exceptional timing, exceptional continuity, able to perform just basic, you know, ET twists, tackle end stunts, whatever it was. But if you can get an offensive lineman in the wrong place, making the wrong read against these stunts, you've got a free rusher, right? I know that's what you saw. That was when San Francisco got a surprising amount of pressure on us in the 49ers game. Mm-hmm. We came in and we said they weren't blitzing. They were just twisting more than we had ever seen them twist, right?
Yep.
And remember, San Francisco, Robert Saleh, defensive coordinator, comes from the Seattle tree. Same sort of system that's run by Chris Richard, defensive coordinator in Seattle. Both of these teams highly increased the number of stunts that we saw on tape before they came to Philadelphia, and it confounded, like you said, especially the left side of that line.
I saw one where there was a stunt on Sheldon Richardson. He was acting as a smasher, so what the smasher is doing is trying to get his guy out of the play, which in this case was Wisniewski. So he gets upfield, he's great with his hands, he's able to reduce his shoulder, reduce his strike zone, get upfield, change the levels that Wisniewski and Vitae were playing on, because Vitae was a little bit too shallow, and Vitae drops, and he goes for Frank Clark. He gets on his heels. Frank Clark comes right behind Richardson, who is taking Wisniewski all the way upfield, and there is nothing but green grass there. And that was just one example that we saw early in the first quarter, and it happened again and again and again. And then we also saw, you know, alerting for blitzes, for the corner blitz. We touched on this on the other show, where Justin Coleman came on a blitz unblocked that Vitae didn't see coming, that Wentz didn't see coming, that the slot receiver didn't see coming, that we had identified the week before, because the Seahawks shaded a little bit on the inside. So typically when you see a safety lined up directly behind a nickel cornerback, that's going to alert you that there's a possible blitz on.
Right, cap corner, that's right.
Right, exactly. So that happened against the Bears. Aguilar had the touchdown on that one because we alerted to it and ran the bubble. In this case, the safety rolled down late in the play clock with an inside shade, so he wasn't directly capped over him, but he ended up taking the slot receiver. And it's things like little nuances like that that we weren't picking up on in that game that led to Seattle just executing a better game plan than we had. And then, you know, you're on the road, communication issues, the play clock's running down, Wentz is clapping for the ball, the safety's rolling down. A lot of things are happening at the same time. time. And having someone like Vitae, who mental processing isn't exactly his strength, teams can really take advantage of that. And they did. They did it with stunts. They did it with corner blitzes. They did it with all types of things. And when you have Aaron Donald and Robert Quinn and company coming to town,
right,
that's an issue. That's something that really, really concerns me. So how do we scheme around that? Do we kind of do it to Vitae's side, kind of like we did with Von Miller to Lane's side in that game plan, where we kind of used Von Miller against himself by getting him upfield and making him the force defender and things of that nature?
Right. It's a tough ask. It really is. And that's why I'm not in the Vitae can be a long-term starter camp. It's because no matter how good of coaches you have, you will never scheme a game correctly.
Right.
All the way through. It's never been done. Think about, you know, I was accused one the other day of calling Carson Wentz a system quarterback because I praised Doug Peterson's system, right? Nobody is going to look at Carson and think he's a system quarterback. Every single game, his biggest play usually comes from some stupid nonsense that he pulls.
Can I point something out? Because Mike Lombardi says that Doug Peterson is successful because Carson Wentz is awesome. Okay, everyone else that had a Carson Wentz take to protect coming in to this whole thing praises Doug Peterson and not Carson Wentz. They're both good. Everyone shut up and stop trying to protect your old takes. Go, Ben.
You're okay, Mike. It's going to be all right. So Carson isn't fully a product of the system. He does amazing things outside of the system that make him such a transcendent player. That has to apply to every player on the field. You know, if you're good at executing and blocking up a twist when it's been correctly identified by your center, you know, by you or just by the quarterback, and you figure out what the defense is doing, you get to your spot and you do your job, that's all well and good. But you're going to be very limited as a player if you don't have the physical tools and the reflexes that blend to adjust to mistakes, to adjust to something that surprises you, right? When it comes to offensive line, the trait that I really look for is balance. Yeah. Because if you don't play with balance, you're screwed. Because if the player doesn't go where you think he's going, you're falling the wrong way because you're not balanced, right? So Big V always falling forward. We see this constantly. We see it on the play that you referenced. Why he's always got his weight in front of his heels, right? His shoulders are ahead of his hips. That's no good. Now, when you play like that, if the rusher comes directly at you, if he comes on the path you anticipate, Big V's one of the heaviest hitters on the Philadelphia Eagles. He will put people in the dirt. He will chuck you so far off your rush path, it doesn't matter if you can beat him later. You're already like 10 yards past where you should be.
Yeah.
If you can fool Big V, if you get him in the wrong spot, he can't recover because he's out of balance. So that's why, you know, you get the concern there. So to answer the question, how do you address schematically a side of the line that really struggles with stunts and with twists? I've alluded to it, you know, what I wanted to see in the Seattle game, we saw with some success. You congest that area.
Whether it be rolling the pockets or whatever you got to do, yeah.
Right. There's a couple of ways you can scheme help to the side of a line, right? You can shift the entire protection. Everybody at the offensive line takes a step to the left at the snap, and they all block the guy to their left, slide protection, right? And this helps the left side of the line. You can also, you know, two jet. You can move a running back over there, a halfback if he's in pass protection. Or, and this was a big moment of debate with Jack Conklin, right tackle for the Tennessee Titans in his rookie year. If you line up a tight end or a wide receiver in a nasty split, a very close split to the line, before the ball is even snapped, is that helping a right tackle? Well, some may argue no. All he does is stand there and then leave. But schematically, from a defensive alignment, by putting that player there, you've greatly adjusted the spacing and the deployment of the front,
right?
The defensive front, the way that they put their front four, their front seven on the field. Once you do this, you can protect a guy, right? And so if I want to run a stunt to the left side of Philadelphia's line, I want there to not be a tight end over there. Mm-hmm. I want there to not be a wide receiver in the slot. Because if there are, now there's more bodies. There's more people. You know, a crackback block screws that entire thing up. And you might be able to run against that. And if you catch a team in a twist on a running play advantageously, you're off to the races.
Yeah.
Because they've just abandon their gaps. That's a great play for the offense. Exactly. And so one of the things that I hope you'll see from Philadelphia, recognizing the struggles that you have from Big V and Wisniewski on the left side, is constantly aligning a tight wide receiver or a tight end, a bunch set to that side of the formation. That's limiting. And Doug Peterson definitely doesn't like that, I can promise you, because he loves to be creative. However, in doing so, you ruin the spacing, you congest the area in which you would run that twist. You can still run them, but it's harder and it'll likely take longer as well.
I agree. And that's something that I featured in the lead up to the Broncos game, was what the Chargers were doing to Von Miller. They were having a wide receiver close to the line, detached to the line, but still in the area to affect the arc or the track that Von Miller was going to take. So that's a great point. Okay, let's kick it over to, because we're going to do our full game preview for this tomorrow as well. You've already touched on it with Locked On Rams with those guys, but we'll dig into it more tomorrow. We're going to kick it over to Game Time Decisions theme music. that I have to put back in there. If you haven't heard Game Time Decisions before, you're a new listener, this is a segment where me and Ben hit each other with off-the-cuff questions that we have not planned before the show. So these are all genuine reactions, random questions, could be football-related, could be anything. Ben, go.
So I saw, I don't know who was discussing this. I'd give you credit if I could. If you're listening, let me know. But I saw somebody talking about this, and I want to know your thoughts, Mike, because I figure you're an amazing trash talker. Knowing you, working with you, I figure you can throw mad shade. You can talk a lot of smack. How do you think Carson Wentz smack talks? Let's just assume he does, because I'm not sure he actually does. But if he does, how do you think Carson Wentz like talks smack?
I think he does it like Andrew Luck. Like, good play, man. Yeah, that was awesome. Good hit, man. Way to be. Way to be. Yeah, I'm just constantly encouraging the guy who just slammed him into the ground. Like, yeah, way to be there, man. You know, like that type of thing. I don't think he says.
Is it sarcastic, or is it just like so genuine that it gets in your head? What's the play there?
I think he's so competitive and probably genuinely like nice, like natured. Mm-hmm. That I think he really means it. Like, obviously, there's a little bit of fire behind it, but I don't think there's anything nefarious behind it.
I agree with that. I think that's a reasonable take. I kind of hope inside that he has, like, a real, real, like, nasty, clever streak that he can pull out very rarely, like, for unique situations. But, you know, like, just, like, he's gotten sacked, like, multiple times. You know, Ryan Kerrigan's up in his face or whatever. Yeah. And he just, like, drops something under his breath that's, like, scathing and comes out of nowhere. Where if Kerrigan repeated it, no one would believe it because it's from Wentz. I kind of hope that's the case, but not really. Yeah. Either way, it's fun to think about Carson trying to talk smack. I agree with you. He wouldn't be very good.
I want to hear him mic'd up and see him in that situation. So I'm going to be looking for that now. Okay, Ben, college or pro, name one team, either offense or defense, that bores you to tears when you watch their film.
What was the team we were watching where I was just saying that their offense was so boring? Oh, Washington. Mm. Washington Redskins offense without Sean McVay is actually exactly what you'd anticipate. You know, you have like an offensive genius who leaves, and then everybody in the building is like, you know, we'll just replicate what he did, but it lacks like the master's touch, right? It lacks like that virtuoso and everything. It's just, it's a facsimile, right? And so it's lifeless. It's just a replica. And you know, Cousins still executing that offense very well. They've woken up a little bit. Jamison Crowder is a little bit more live working out of the slot now as of late. But definitely when the Eagles play the Redskins that second time, I believe it was week 7, maybe week 5. It was an odd week in the middle. I don't remember.
Yeah.
But when they played that week and I went back into the film, I was just watching the offense like, this is so pitiful. This is just really sad. They don't have the weapons they had to execute this offense, and they don't have the play caller who knew how to execute this offense. And so it's just kind of jumbled and messy and broken.
Plus, they're on the 21st incarnation of their line, so they really can't get too fancy with anything just by that natural handcuff. Yeah, I would agree. Their offense is deadly boring. All right, hit me with one, Ben.
I want to know, and this was more so to be before the Seahawks game, but we can still ask it now, because I was making this joke and it actually like, brought up a pretty significant conversation. Who is the grandpa coach of the NFL? Who is the grandpa coach? Is it Doug Peterson or is it Pete Carroll? Because I feel like they're resoundingly the top two grandpas. Like, they just fit that mold, that prototype. But who takes the cake? Who takes the gold home?
I think there's something gleefully childish underneath the exterior of Doug Peterson. However, as far as a grandpa that I would want, like, around, like, Thanksgiving, probably be Pete Carroll, throwing the ball around him in the backyard, you know, just chopping it up with the boys and whatnot.
I mean, I like the childish thing underneath Doug Peterson because of the premature explosion quote, obviously. Yeah. Like, that's what I was thinking of. But I got multiple responses where, without prompting, they would say one person is the grandpa and the other one's like the weird uncle who shows up to holidays. I didn't say like, which one's the grandpa, which one's the weird uncle. I just said grandpa. And I had one response where it was, you know, oh, Peterson's definitely the grandpa. Carol's more like weird uncle who like smokes in the like living room and like makes off color jokes or whatever. And then I have a response like 10 minutes later that goes, oh, Carol's definitely the grandpa. Peterson's the weird uncle who like shows up kind of drunk. And I was like, wow, they're grandpa and weird uncle prototypes are very similar in the eyes of NFL viewers.
Yeah, that, and when you click on their profile, one's got a, you know, a 49ers banner and the other one's got like an Eagles banner. So they definitely have agendas. All right, Ben, how often do you clean your ears?
With Q-tips?
Yeah.
I don't. You're not supposed to.
Really?
Yeah, it's dangerous. It's not good. You end up packing earwax in over your eardrums and you can put stress on them. No, this is very serious. You're not supposed to. I once did. Like, you know, that was the thing. But then I read an article, and I do this a lot, Mike. I read articles, and I change things. I read an article. It said it's not healthy. I don't do it. So now I just kind of wash them out when I'm in the shower. That's my move.
Really? And you don't? Yeah. Okay. That's strange. I got to stop
doing
that.
I'm telling
you.
Look it up. You're not supposed to put Q-tips in your ears. Not good.
Google is a lot of work to do all that. I mean, I got all these Q-tips in the house. What am I going to do with them? Throw them out? I paid for those things.
I still have a bunch of Q-tips that just like sit here now and don't do anything. It's actually a good point. All right. I have a way to implement targeting ejections in the NFL, and I want to hear your thoughts. Because right now I like the fact that college has the ability to eject a player for a full four quarters, you know, the rest of a game if it's in the first half, and then the second half of a game and the first half of the next game if the penalty occurs in the second half. I like the fact that they can do that. I think that that's good, and I think that that will over time lower the incidence of head-to-head collisions in football. I do believe that. But one of the biggest complaints about that method is game stoppage, because they go to review to see if it was worthy of ejection. And obviously, we do not need more game stoppages in the current NFL market. We need less. We definitely need less, and there's conversations to be had there. What if you can be ejected for targeting, but that review goes to the booth immediately, play just resumes, and then if you're to be ejected, once they make that decision, if it's one play, two plays, three plays later, one of the refs is like, all right, dude, you got to leave. And then you go off the field and play just continues to go. Hmm. Does that make sense?
I got to feel like so many people would complain about though. Like he shouldn't have been on that field for the, you know, for the interception that he had, and then he gets ejected a play later.
which is you know, that's the scary thing. And I think the other complaint might be, all right, what if it's your team is winning by four and your star corner gets hit with a targeting penalty? He gets to stay in the game for another two or three plays until they make up their mind, where the other team's offense says, no, get him off the field if you want to drive, right? Because then you say, all right, within 2 minutes of the end of a half, let's stop the clock to make sure it doesn't get extra plays. But then if you're stopping the clock, you're giving an advantage to the teams because there's so little time left. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So there's definitely kinks to iron out. They said, you know, obviously Roger Goodell just got his new $200 million contract, you know, making that cheddar. And he said that they'll be talking in the offseason about adding targeting into the NFL. And this is how I think it should be done.
I like that. I think that's interesting. I think you definitely have some kinks to work out, but I like the general idea, because I freaking hate stoppages, man. All the commercials that they have, they come back from a review after a commercial, and then they run one play, and it's a 2-minute warning, and you get another commercial, and then there's another time. And,
right.
Yeah, it's nonsense.
I mean, what if he gets the targeting call, he has to go wait on the sidelines?
Right,
the
I was thinking that too.
Through, yeah, if the review comes through and says it wasn't targeting, then he can go back in. All right, I have my targeting proposal. I'm going to draft it. I'm going to send it to Goodell.
Ben, are you happy about Roger Goodell getting his contract just to spite Jerry Jones?
I definitely am a big fan of the fact that Jerry was at one point, you know, saying he was going to block this whole situation, and then it doesn't come through. Obviously, he kind of changed his tune on that. The Goodell thing, here's what I'm going to reserve my opinion on Goodell's extension until we encounter the new CBA. We get to that point.
Right.
Because obviously right now, and I don't know if you saw Mike Mitchell's rant. Did you see this?
No, I didn't.
Right. So Mike Mitchell, safety for the Steelers, who obviously the Steelers and the Bengals just came out of that Monday night slugfest, you know, slobber knocker of a game. Very vocal at his locker today. No filter. Talking about how upset he is about the way the penalties are doled out, and how the NFL seems two-faced on player health, and how suspensions aren't equitable, you know, with Gronk and with Juju Smith-Schuster and with George Aloka, whose suspension has been revoked. Saying all of these things, you know, he was very anti-Goodell vocal in his tirade, which makes sense. You know, Goodell's easily a public figure for that sort of angst. Number one, there's not recognition that, you know, the NFLPA is, in my opinion, equally or perhaps a little bit less as fault for this sort of a situation, number one. But there's so much now of a name recognition, there's so much of a taboo, a stigma around Goodell's name, that I wonder how effective he can be as the NFL commissioner when the time to bargain the new CBA comes around, because he's already has so many staunch, entrenched, you know, opponents kind of around the league. You know, you could put Mike Mitchell's name in there amongst others. We're all anticipating a lockout, and it feels weird to extend the commissioner with whom a lockout is anticipated, knowing that a lockout is anticipated. That feels odd to me.
Yeah.
Right? Now we could all be wrong. You know, there could not be a lockout. But from what I understand, which obviously I'm on the outside looking in, the stigma, yeah, against Goodell is so significant that I wonder about his efficacy in doing that huge, monumental, probably primary part of his job, which is creating the CBA, the collective bargaining agreement, with the Players Association. That is what, like, that's Commissioner 101 right there. So that, you know, that gives me a lot of pause. The thing is, I can't speak on any alternatives because I don't know anything about that, right? And so I can't say, you should have done this, because I don't know anything. But it's going to be very interesting. I believe the year is 2020 that we're looking at for the new CBA, and that's going to be a very interesting year in the NFL.
Yeah, for sure. Screw Goodell. and Jerry Jones. Anyway, all right, so tomorrow we're going to be doing the full preview for the Los Angeles Rams against the Philadelphia Eagles. Ben, got anything else for the gentle listeners?
Not really, nothing I can think of. This LA Rams game, this entire slate of this weekend is huge for the NFC playoffs. This is some people have called this a do or die game for Philadelphia. Let's take about 100 chill pills. This team is 10-2. If the Cowboys lose, the division is won. All right. And let's assume the Cowboys are going to drop at least one more game this season. It's fine, people. But yeah, this is a big game. So just get pumped for that. It's going
to
be fun.
It's a do or die for Eagles fans that like to talk a bunch of trash on Twitter because they'll get a bunch of ammo that can be thrown back at them. That's why it's do or die. It's not do or die for the actual Eagles. Right. Everyone calm down. All right. Remember to go to LockedOnEagles.com and keep it locked on here on Locked On Eagles. Fly, Eagles, fly.
Cuckoo.